commitments to resistance fighters and all of those who are assisting the resistance. In this context, we owe people like Haji Satabatabai a lot.
The unveiling ceremony of his biography, along with the unveiling of a commemorative stamp, made this year's ceremony even more special.
I believe that every now and then in our region, we need to call out the names of those who have dedicated their lives to the resistance front out loud. This is the main purpose of the conference on resistance fighters abroad.
Traditionally, the annual conference is held on the martyrdom anniversary of the all-time role model of resistance fighters abroad, the 8th Shia Imam, Imam Reza alayhi salam, who was martyred far away from his homeland in the Iranian city of Mashhad, and ends on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan al-Askari alayhi salam, the 11th Shia Imam.
The closing ceremony of the conference will be held next week on the 24th of September in the holy city of Mashhad, northeastern Iran. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Peace talks between Ansarullah and Saudi delegates are in progress in the Saudi kingdom's capital. In this round of negotiations, the focus is on finding ways to alleviate the humanitarian crisis caused by the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The head of the Ansarullah national delegation team, Muhammad Abdesalam, believes if talks are successful, it could lead to an ultimate political solution.
No doubt we will discuss the payment of salaries to Yemeni employees, opening the airports and seaports, prisoner exchange, the withdrawal of all foreign military forces, and rebuilding Yemen, which could lead to a political solution.
One of the main topics to be discussed is the presence of foreign military personnel scattered throughout areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition. In recent years, the Yemeni islands have been transformed into military bases and airfields operated by the UAE and Western military forces.
There can be no peace until foreign military troops withdraw from Yemeni islands and withdraw forces from the provinces of Hadhramaut, Ma'rib, and Shabwa. If the occupation does not end, there will never be peace.
Even if peace talks succeed in ending the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, will it be enough to end the war if foreign forces remain in the country?
The Ansarullah delegation has made it very clear. Foreign military troops must leave the entire Yemeni land. And if this is something that is not accomplished through peaceful negotiations, the Ansarullah-backed government will continue to fight. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Sick Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip continue to suffer due to Israel's illegal and inhuman practices. According to a report released on Wednesday by the UK-based organization Save the Children, the Israeli regime has deprived some 400 Palestinian children in Gaza of vital medical care in the first half of 2023. Gazans, including patients, must obtain special permits to leave the territory through an Israeli-controlled crossing. Human rights groups have raised the alarm over Israel's violation of international laws by depriving Gazans of their freedom of movement.
Israel continues to violate international laws and norms by denying patients and their companions the necessary permits to travel outside Gaza. Israel is endangering the lives of those sick children by depriving them of urgent medical care.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs needed for treating patients suffering from severe illnesses. Last year, three Gazan children died while waiting for their exit permits. Press TV met with the Zidane family in the southern Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis. Israel has repeatedly denied them an exit permit.
My son is very sick and needs urgent medical care outside Gaza. He's 15 months old and only weighs 5 kilograms. There's no medical treatment for him in Gaza, and Israel refuses to grant us exit permits. I call on the whole world to save my son.
Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished Gaza can be a stressful and unpredictable process. Nearly 1,100 patients have died in the territory because of the Israeli blockade in the past 16 years.
There is no secret about the procedures which have been implemented against the Palestinian besieged Gaza Strip over the past 16 years, and especially over the past year, in which the Israeli authorities have denied entry to many hundreds of Palestinian children from getting medical treatment in the West Bank and East Jerusalem hospitals, and that is consistent with the Israeli apartheid regime.
The health sector in Gaza has been grappling with acute shortage of medicines due to the Israeli blockade in place since 2007. Tel Aviv's blockade has taken its toll on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip. Hundreds of Palestinian patients, including children, have already lost their lives due to Israel's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Leader of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Kim Jong-un, traveled to Russia this week for a tour and summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The DPRK's Kim visited a cosmodrome as he hopes to develop satellite technology.
I am honored that President Putin has shown a deep interest, provided an opportunity to engage in a conference at a space launch facility, and given us a chance to gain deeper understanding of the current and future of a space power nation.
The DPRK leader also toured a jet fighter facility as Russia and the DPRK deepen their relations. Warnings from the U.S. against DPRK-Russia cooperation continued, this time from officials planning extended deterrence with their South Korean counterparts.
In the context of mounting DPRK threats to regional stability, the United States will continue its efforts to counter any and all threats to the U.S.-ROK alliance.
The U.S. strategy of extended deterrence refers to the so-called nuclear umbrella, the U.S. commitment to use all of its forces, including nuclear weapons, in defense of an ally, in this case, South Korea. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has sought to strengthen that commitment with the routine deployment here of U.S. nuclear-capable weapons. Experts in Seoul, however, feel that the deployment of more U.S. weapons causes the DPRK only to invest further in its own military deterrence.
These actions by South Korea, the United States, and Japan are not contributing to eliminating the DPRK's nuclear weapons, but bringing the DPRK, China, and Russia closer and militarily strengthening the country. So the attempted deterrence of the DPRK's nuclear program is actually causing its nuclear program and missiles to be strengthened.
Earlier this week, South Korea announced its intention to purchase 25 more U.S. F-35 Joint Strike fighter jets. Frank Smith, Seoul.
It all started with smiles and warm applause as Ursula von der Leyen began delivering her annual State of the Union speech in the European Parliament on Wednesday. The head of the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, painted a rosy picture.
Together, we have shown that when Europe is bold and united, it gets things done.
The atmosphere in the chamber soon changed.
À l'appel de l'histoire.
It's time to come down from the ivory tower. One third in the EU, millions, don't have enough to eat because of inflation. You didn't say a single word about them today.
One lawmaker even questioned how von der Leyen can sleep at night.
95 million people in the EU are threatened by poverty. There is a broken energy market while the energy and arms industries are making record profits.
The Commission President was told the so-called working poor are being ignored. Experts confirm it is a growing phenomenon in the EU.
People can be homeless and have a job. There's in-work homelessness, but there's also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
Von der Leyen told lawmakers she's proposing 50 billion euro for Ukraine from the EU budget up to 2027. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. A number of legislators criticised the EU's position with regards to Russia.
The failed sanctions policy, sorry to say, that hasn't really helped Ukraine in any meaningful way. It hasn't brought the end of the war any closer, but it's hurting the European economy and European people.
Slovakian MEP Miroslav Radatovsky claimed the real purpose behind the war in Ukraine is for the United States to occupy Europe and the world. Separately, a number of lawmakers criticised how refugees are treated by the EU if they are not from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Vatican envoy, Cardinal Matteo Zuppi, has landed in Beijing for a three-day meeting with China's high officials. The People's Republic of China and the Vatican have not shared diplomatic relations since 1951, so this will be the first high-level meeting between the two states in more than 70 years. The Vatican's initiative is aimed at paving paths to peace in Ukraine. This, as the European Union has done almost nothing to ease tensions in the conflict, as Italy's Vice Prime Minister said during a press conference on Wednesday.
A smaller state like the Vatican is doing much more for ending the conflict in Ukraine than the European Union. I wish the Vatican envoy best of luck. I hope the war will end soon because it has multiple ramifications. Poland's government decision to call on the EU to further extend the embargo on imports of Ukrainian grain is one of them, and it is highly worrying.
Vatican envoy Zuppi has also traveled to Kiev and Moscow in June and to Washington, D.C. in July as part of attempts to bring Ukraine and Russia to the negotiating table. However, high officials in Kiev have excluded the possibility of Vatican success in resolving the military conflict. More specifically, Ukrainian authorities have said Pope Francis cannot mediate in the Ukraine war because he is pro-Russian. The head of the Holy See, Pope Francis, has often angered Kiev and those supporting Ukraine in the war with Russia. If on one side, the 86-year-old pontiff has repeatedly expressed sympathy with the Ukrainians, on the other, he has also expressed understanding for Vladimir Putin's strategy in Ukraine by saying NATO was barking at Russia's door by expanding east, and lately by praising Russia's imperial past.
I'd like to point out that the Vatican's geopolitical approach to this conflict is multilateral. That's why the papal envoy has already been to Ukraine, Russia, and the US. The Holy See believes that holding a neutral position can open doors for peace initiatives, in contrast with the interests of arms suppliers.
Since February, Beijing has been promoting a 12-point peace plan, which features, among other things, a ceasefire, a resumption of peace talks, and the termination of unilateral sanctions against Russia. However, Ukraine has replied to China that it would not accept any peace proposal involving loss of territory or freezing the conflict. Max Civili, Rome.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on her own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations, too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice, and the very least to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution, an attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved, and it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pariza, London.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A change seems to be on the horizon as some African states are uniting and saying enough is enough to exploitation, colonialization, and degradation. According to a security pact signed on Friday, any attack on the sovereignty and territorial integrity of one or more contracting parties shall be considered as aggression against the other parties and shall give rise to a duty of assistance, including the use of armed force to restore and ensure security. Now, this is the security pact that three of the Sahel countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, have signed. We're going to be taking a look at what it all means on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Abiyomi Azakiri, editor Pan-African Newswire, out of Detroit. And Netford Freeman, Coordinating Committee member, Black Alliance for Peace, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with me. Well, I'm going to start off in Detroit. And Abiyomi, I mean, since the Berlin Conference in 1844, when Europeans divided Africa amongst themselves, putting arbitrary lines and boundaries and even dividing some tribes, same tribes, Africans have had difficulty in uniting. In your opinion, how significant has the role of colonialism been in keeping African nations divided?
It's been essential because the attempts by the European imperialist powers were all centered around a strategy of divide and conquer. We saw this during the period of the national liberation movements when they attempted to divide the various freedom fighters based upon regional as well as nationality differences. However, during the 1960s and 1970s, there were alliances that were formed. You had CONCEP, which was a coalition of anti-Portuguese colonialist groups, principally in Southern Africa, but also included Guinea-Bissau.
Right.
There was the Southern African Development Community. Today, we have a critical situation, and particularly in the Sahel region in West Africa. The Leptako-Gourma Charter, which was signed yesterday by Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, breaks ground, moving in a very positive and progressive direction, because these countries are under threat, principally from France, but also from the United States as well, even though
okay.
the U.S.
We're going to get into that a little bit further. Let me get Netfa in on this discussion. Netfa, what are the main tactics, one of the main tactics of the colonialists and imperialists has been to put their own person in power of the majority of African nations. And if there was a leader who really wanted to help his people, he was overthrown, imprisoned, or simply killed. The situation in these three countries seemed to be different this time around. What do you think?
Yeah, yes, it's different this time around in the sense that there's been an emerging of forces that are not only, well, they're decidedly anti-France, and that they're not being handpicked because they performed a military takeover of the existing governments that were in the favor of both France and the United States. And right now they're also being, will you say, boosted and supported by the masses of the people who are cheering them in the streets relentlessly. We're seeing a decidedly anti-France because of the traditional colonizing disposition or role that France played. We're not seeing as much the same with the U.S. because it doesn't have that, but things can quickly turn. Hopefully they, in my view, I think it should turn to understand
well, well,
that
let me just jump in here. How dangerous is that perspective, Netfa? Because you said there is showing a definite anti-French perspective, the people in the street, but not so much anti-United States. Is that dangerous for their movement?
Well, I believe so, in the sense that the undergirding thing is neocolonialism, as our previous guest, Zikwe, pointed out. Well, it was neocolonialism, the structure of neocolonialism. The United States is the dominant neocolonial power in the world, and to really rid, if the objective is not just to get rid of the former colonizer, and it's to rid yourself of neocolonialism as the prevailing political and economic order, then the United States has to be included in that.
Okay, well, Abayomi, let's talk about the significance of this security pact in general, which has been signed by these three countries, in your perspective.
I think it's tremendously historic because they're under threat. They're attempting to get the Economic Community of West African States, led by Nigeria today, to mobilize a military intervention inside the country. It has not been successful so far due to the widespread unity within all three countries and among all these three states. However, at the same time, there's widespread opposition within the other ECOWAS states as well. In Nigeria, the Senate has opposed any military intervention. Political parties have signed a statement jointly opposing any type of military intervention. And you raised the issue about the United States. They'll have to confront the United States because the U.S., as Netfa pointed out, is the dominant neocolonial power internationally. But France works as a subservient neocolonial power. It's very limited what they can do without the support and assistance of Washington.
Netfa, part of this pact says that even if armed force is necessary, it will be used to ensure security. What is this really saying, especially when we talk about France, which has not ruled out invading Niger?
So there's a lot of the three countries actually face a lot of, and we already, you know, touched on it already, a lot of threats that are external and even kind of internal. Mm-hmm. The violent extremism, which also the pact is designed to address as well, the jihadists that really are a product of the U.S. and pretty much the product of the U.S., particularly in the destruction of Libya in 2011, which spread that, you know, element across the Sahel. But those elements are still there. Unfortunately, Niger is in a difficult position because it also has this big, you know, the United States has invested a lot with multi-million dollars of drone bases and military bases there. But there's two things, and because we also realizing that while Niger has kicked out the France and is in the and going to expel, wants to expel the ambassadors and everything, it has permitted the resuming U.S. to be able to resume its operations there. I can't judge what that means. It could be one that they don't want to earn the ire of the U.S., which really has no intention of going anywhere either. And also the fact that maybe there's some intelligence value in terms of their drone. There's both surveillance and defense drones that are used that they can also get from to fight off the jihadist elements that are there. So it's complicated. Niger is in a complicated situation. It doesn't, you know, diminish the fact that the U.S. really has to be eliminated from Africa. But this is a complicated situation. But I do agree that the pact is very good. And in the instance that either France or through ECOWAS or even if the United States decided to have some military action, that pact would have to make a decision to even defend themselves against something like that.
Well, Abayomi, what is your perspective about ECOWAS? It's been talked about a couple of times already in this program. Your overall perspective about this group?
In theory, it's a positive development. It started in around 1975 and was promoted by people like the late President Ahmed Secretary of the Republic of Guinea. Since that time period, however, they have fallen victim to the same neo-colonial narrative. Today, for example, with the chairmanship of ECOWAS being in the hands of Nigeria, the president there, Bola Tinubu, unfortunately, has taken a pro-U.S. position, a pro-France position, and was willing to use his own troops and the troops of other regional states to militarily intervene in the affairs of a neighbor. Niger shares a northern border with Nigeria. Population is about 25 million people, 10 times smaller than that of neighboring Nigeria. Unfortunately, ECOWAS has fallen victim to the same pro-imperialist outlook that others have fallen victim to. But that can change if there's a movement, a strong anti-imperialist movement, which exists right now and is expanding in West Africa. That can easily be reversed. They've suspended the three states that have had these military changes in power. Nonetheless, the masses of people in West Africa right now are becoming more and more political conscious.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Nedva, I mean, we know ECOWAS had threatened Niger but didn't attack. Again, sort of there are talks about the possibility. Do you think that at the end of the day, ECOWAS will attack on behalf of the French? Because they are, the French are definitely trying to get them to do their dirty work for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really hard to say. It really wouldn't be in the interest of these, what we refer to as the comprador leaders of these countries. They've already experienced, like was just alluded to, a backlash in their countries for even suggesting that they're supporting the French in this. And so, and even some of them have had to make, you know, have sought to make purges in their military because they thought they were going to end up being subjected to the same fate as and being taken over. It wouldn't be in their best interest, but at the same time, as a comprador class, those that are really doing the exist for the interest of outside powers, they really are in a rock and a hard place because it's either go the way of supporting your people and doing the right thing, or being ousted for supporting the imperialists. But they, you know, they're not going to change in terms of politically to start working for the mass of the people. So they're really in a right. It's hard to predict something like that. I think at the end of the day, they may. I don't know. That's the answer.
What would that mean? I mean, Abayomi, because if ECOWAS would actually attack, and now with this pact that has been signed yesterday, what would that mean for the region?
The governments that will be leading this military intervention would be endangered by their own people. A lot of these regimes are very fragile, even including Nigeria, even though it's considered mm-hmm. the largest economy on the African continent. There's tremendous economic and social problems in existence there. For example, the trade union movement just over a week ago had a nationwide strike there against the rising inflation. Nigeria has failed to build oil refineries, and they've lifted subsidies on fuel. So the inflation rate is enormous, and this is happening in many other African states. So if they allow France or the United States to prompt them to militarily intervene in neighboring states, they themselves could easily be overthrown by the military with the support of the majority of the people within those societies.
Wenetho, what do you think about the possibility of the French attacking directly Niger?
I would not rule it out. I think we'd be naive to rule it out. France is heavily dependent on Niger and all of these, all of the new colonial states. For them, the collapse of neocolonialism in Africa for them and their role, its role is sustaining electricity, all kind of the economy of France is huge. And so they really, so we wouldn't want to underestimate the desperation that they may be feeling by having to being faced with the threat of losing their neo colonies. So I don't, you know, it's something that I think is a real possibility. However, it also suggests that it's going to be a regional situation, and may even, I don't know, international conflicts could emerge from this in terms of the global South versus the global North.
What are the chances that we will see a rise in terrorism in the region, as some Western countries have been accused of using terrorists to usher in their own goals whenever needed? And that would be a way to, of course, destabilize.
It's already going on right now in northern Mali. There's been a resurgence of some of the Tuareg rebel groups in their attacks against the government in Bamako. It's also happened in Niger, as well as Burkina Faso. In regard to France, it's been accusations made that they are funding the Boko Haram insurgent group in northeastern Nigeria. France is desperate, as Detfa pointed out. The president, Emmanuel Macron, said just 2 days ago that the ambassador there, the French ambassador to Niger, who has been asked to leave several weeks ago, is being held hostage. Mm-hmm. That is a complete lie. But these are the type of provocative accusations that are being made to perhaps justify some type of a commando strike on Niamey, the capital of Niger.
Well, you mentioned about the accusation and that they're holding the ambassador hostage after Niger has demanded that he leaves. I mean, let's talk about the arrogance, Netfa, on the part of the French. Isn't that part of the problem, has always been the problem to begin with, that they have never seen the Africans or African countries as equals, but looking at them in a very derogative or less than position?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a disposition inherited from colonization and white supremacy of colonization. And being that France has had some of the most pervasive clutches in terms of their former, I won't even say former colonies, but present neo-colonies, like, for example, the imposition of the CFA franc, this currency that they impose on the African countries, their former colonies. And then also, I mean, Macron said something very arrogant. He was saying that said that African countries aren't able to manage their own affairs. This kind of disposition has always been the sort of white man's burden type of thing that has come along with colonization. We're here to civilize you, and you're not able to do things on your own, and so our domination of you is basically for your own good. So the arrogance, that same arrogance, and coupled with their desperation as well, we're not going to leave. We don't recognize what the masses of the people are supporting because they don't know any better. And so we're not even going to leave. And then, you know, so they can claim things like all kinds of lies. The ambassador's being held hostage, when in fact, if the situation is if he comes out of the embassy, they would be escorted outside of the country, which is what the Africans should be in their right to do. It's like, we don't want you here. We should be able to expel you from our country.
Right. Well, Abayomi, we've seen in the past, we've had African leaders who really try to help their people, and we know what happened to them. How likely is it right now, assassination plots, these type of things, especially with these leaders who've signed the security pact?
We can be very certain that these conspiracies are well underway. You've mentioned the historical attacks that have been made on Pan-African leadership. Patrice Lumumba is a good example. Felix Mumi from the Cameroon. We had the overthrow of Kwame Nkrumah in 1966. There's been so many. Thomas Sankara, who was overthrown in 1987 at the aegis of French imperialism. So yes, I'm sure the leaders of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger are very aware of these plots that are going on, and that's why they're signing these agreements to intensify their military cooperation as well as intelligence coordination.
Nedfa, what is making this era different from before? Why have we witnessed several coups, and they're all very anti-French, and condemning Paris for its exploitation of the continent? It's not as if the exploitation just started. So what has brought all of this together to where we are today, in your perspective?
Well, I think, you know, nothing like this can last, sustain itself forever. But then also the generations now have the benefit of hindsight. We have legacies of freedom fighters and even those who have done things like Thomas Sankara, for example, in Burkina Faso, who led a coup and then turned it around and created a very formidable socialist society that was benefiting the mass of the people. Now, there's a saying that they used to have, and I think it was said a lot around you can kill the lion, but what will you do with the cubs? So as generations of feeder fighters before us in history and movements on the ground by the young people, like even in the Congo, different French young people have been politicizing their people over time. And this is I think this is the result of it, that no one is going to the global economy, you know, the polarization and intensification of poverty and disparities and all of these things coming together means that something was about to break. And I think these are the positive developments where French is being, you know, kicked out and that the pacts are being created. It's a new historical day. We have the legacy of Pan-Africanism during the 60s, 50s, throughout the 50s to the 70s, in terms of trying to establish a united African, understanding African unity as being essential to warding off, fending off colonialism and neocolonialism. These things don't just disappear, and we're seeing coming in this form today.
Well, Abayomi, Netfa just talked about African unity and alliances. How likely are we to see this spread? We have this pact right now with these three countries, but as we've been talking, a lot of the people inside, a lot of Africans inside of their countries right now are not happy with their governments. How likely are we to see this spread?
It's very likely, and I believe it's going to come from the ground up, meaning from the workers, the farmers, the youth, the revolutionary intellectuals and artists. They're going to be the motivating social forces to build and to renew the Pan-African struggle towards African unification. It's going to be essential because what we see in the Western imperialist countries, for example, France, they have had all types of social problems this year, uprising on the part of the working class over pension reform. We saw the mass rebellions over the summer, over the killing of Nihil, where descendants of African migrants rose up against the French state. So now they have a problem in West Africa. So there's no solution for imperialism in Africa. The only real solution is that the masses rise up, unify, and toss out these imperialist powers and their puppets.
Ned, for your perspective, what needs to happen in these countries for them to reach true independence and have control of their natural resources?
And I think most of it was already said by my colleague Abami Zigwe, but I would just maybe the only thing I could add, and maybe was already implicit in what he said, is that forms of participatory democracy and redistribution of wealth and those kind of projects have to take place. We're seeing some of it even in Burkina Faso, some remnants of efforts in that regard. But eventually, the people have to be able to be running the government, and they also maybe have to look at different global relationships, international relationships, in which we see with the multipolar world, things like the BRICS and the G77 is going on in Havana, you know, and non-aligned movement, reemerging of that. Those will have to be utilized in terms of international relations.
And on that note, I thank both of you gentlemen for being with me on the spotlight. Abayomi Azikiwe, editor, Pan-African Newswire out of Detroit. Netford Freeman, coordinating committee member, Black Alliance for Peace out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The World Bank has long been accused of reneging on its climate commitments. According to reports, the World Bank spent nearly $15 billion supporting fossil fuels since Paris Accords. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote, an analysis released recently by the German nonprofit Erde World estimated that the World Bank spent nearly $4 billion on fossil fuel financing last year, when it was under the leadership of a climate denier nominated by former US President Donald Trump. The World Bank pledged in 2017 to end financing for upstream oil and gas, with narrow exceptions after 2019. But Erde World observed in its new report that the World Bank's pledge applied only to direct finance, allowing the powerful institution to funnel cash to oil and gas projects through trade finance dished out by its private sector arm, the International Finance Cooperation, IFC. Erde World noted, despite trade finance's vast and a still growing share of the IFC's budget, over 70% of it is given out in secrecy. The types of goods and businesses it is funding are now even reported to the World Bank's shareholders, that is, our governments. The public has a right to know where all this money is going. We'll be right back. citing the IFC's severe lack of transparency, Erdwald stressed that it was only able to formulate an estimate for oil and gas transactions. The group calculated that the World Bank spent roughly $3.7 billion on oil and gas trade finance in 2022. Erdwald's hike, Menhart said in a statement, this would more than triple the current annual level of fossil fuel finance attributed to the World Bank and cast serious doubts on bank claims of alignment with the Paris Climate Agreement. The easiest way for a big oil company or coal operation to escape attention surrounding public assistance is to cloak it in trade finance. The World Bank has long been accused of reneging on its climate commitments. A report released last year by Big Shift Global estimated that the World Bank has spent nearly $15 billion supporting fossil fuels since the adoption of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. Late last year, former World Bank president David Malpass sparked global outrage by saying he's not sure whether he accepts the scientific consensus that climate change is caused by the burning of fossil fuels, further validating climate activists' long-standing calls for systematic reforms at the bank. Malpass said in response to a reporter's question about his views on climate change, I don't know. I'm not a scientist. The comments prompted widespread calls for Malpass to step down, which he did in June. Current World Bank President Ajay Banga, who U.S. President Joe Biden nominated to replace Malpass, is a former private equity executive who has worked for some companies, including Citibank. Erdwald warned in its report recently that the World Bank will remain a major source of funding for the fossil fuel industry until it enacts reforms that prevent the IFC from bolstering oil and gas under the guise of trade finance. The group said the easiest way for a big oil company or coal operation to escape attention surrounding public assistance is to cloak it in trade finance. It is a huge loophole that must be closed and evaluated through public disclosure. Erdwald added that there is no doubt the World Bank and IFC are going to deny its findings and claim the figures are inaccurate. That's exactly what an IFC spokesperson did recently, telling The Guardian that Erdwald's report contains serious factual inaccuracies and grossly overstates IFC's support for fossil fuels. The spokesperson added, IFC regularly reports accurate and timely project information through various channels. Erdwald disputed that narrative in its report, asserting that the continued secrecy surrounding trade finance makes it impossible to determine how much fossil fuel business the IFC is ultimately facilitating and whether the World Bank is actually aligned with the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. The group said an exorbitant amount of IFC money, that is more than half of its budget, is streaming through banks without any oversight by the World Bank Board of Directors, without any opportunity for public scrutiny, without any accountability.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the prisoner exchange conducted between Iran and the United States was a purely humanitarian measure. Iran says those countries that blocked Iran's assets under U.S. pressure must